Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 30th of January, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we will be joined for our news today by Dr. Graham Downing, who will be speaking about the subject of the film Vaxxed and Vaccinations. Well, I've got to say, it's pretty grey, gloomy, wet, slightly chilly here in Plymouth. That's it on the weather. We'll leave it there.
Well, things heating up between Britain and America because Donald Trump has announced that he's establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States. We don't want them here, is what he said. So people coming from certain countries will not be given access to the US. As a result, Labour Party decided they were going to attempt to get Boris Johnson into the Houses of Parliament today to give his comments on it. This was Emily Thornberry. And Jeremy Corbyn said that Mrs. May should cancel Donald Trump's state visit to the UK later in the year, whenever until the ban is lifted, in fact. So what did Boris have to say? He had some really profound words. He said, "We will protect the rights and freedoms of UK nationals at home and abroad, except when we're bombing them with drones, of course." He said, "Divisive and wrong to stigmatise because of nationality."
Well, he's changed his tune then a bit, hasn't he? Because, you know, before they were drawing up a hit list of British nationals who, as you say, were going to be killed with drone strikes. So what is this? Boris, fake news?
Yes.
Probably is. I had her along the same lines that Theresa May was pregnant. That apparently emerged after a meeting with Donald Trump. But I was told earlier this morning that is not true.
Ah, okay. Be a problem for leather trousers?
It wouldn't suit her leather trousers very well at all. Well, let's come on to the BBC. And we have been watching the BBC very carefully because, of course, the BBC has set itself forward as a 3.65 billion organisation to check other people's news reporting. And I was fascinated with this little article. Note the title or the header, "How We Started the Arab World's Biggest Music Service." I initially took that to be the BBC. I've read this article very carefully. I think it is the BBC talking about themselves, but there's obviously some interesting stuff going on behind the scenes. The journalist, Carolina Valladares, I'd never heard of this lady before. We'll come on to her in a minute. Well, is it the BBC or is it Angami, if I've pronounced that properly? The article is about Angami and how a couple of gentlemen put one word in a notebook and now they've got a music library of more than 20 million songs. 500 million songs are streamed a month to 30 million users. And they did it all on their own, Mike.
That's amazing.
I think it is amazing. And I think there's something else to it. We haven't found it yet. But if anybody can help us dig into this story, the BBC, I believe, is spinning. I won't say it's fake news, but I think this is a spun story. So let's have a look at the journalist. Here she is. This is her Twitter page. Fascinated. She's been operating in Beirut and the Lebanon. She's got the big press on her T-shirt or a shirt there. And she's been reporting, amongst other things, on Aleppo. And this was an interesting tweet. "A white helmet in Aleppo tells me every time we receive a call, we're scared for what we're going to see. Bodies, kids without heads, limbs." So in light of what we now know about the white helmets, that's interesting. And note the other tweet there, because she says that Article 534 of the Lebanese Penal Code still states that sexual acts which contradict the laws of nature are punishable by up to 1 year in jail. She's clearly criticising that. So we've got an embedded journalist. What she seems to be doing is attacking the culture of the Lebanese state. And she's a BBC reporter who's happy to praise the white helmets. I think there's something a little bit untoward there. But let's come in a slightly different angle. This is the Daily Mail. It's a story from a few weeks ago, but it was how you pay $4 million to fund Ethiopian Spice Girls. And the key thing about this story is that the $4 million has come from the Department for International Development, and it says it addresses the issues using role models to champion the potential of Ethiopian girls in ways which are accessible and are relevant. This is British soft political power being drifted in by using the pop industry. So back to the BBC, and of course the BBC very active in Lebanon, and they're crowing that they've created this award-winning program, Shankabout, or Boot, which is basically talking about emotive issues in the country. So the BBC doing what it loves best, which is taking a stable country, starting to stir people's emotions. And if I add a bit to that, this is obviously from BBC Media Action's own webpage here. I've called it British foreign policy injected by social media by the BBC. They say online drama Shankabout connecting young people in the Arab world. And if you're in any doubt that this is actually British foreign policy, there's the funder direct from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. So we can now see what this soft power that Theresa May is talking about. This is using any form of power which is not immediately identifiable as being British overseas policies. You get inside the nation, you get control of their media, you get control of the young people, and you stir it on social media. This is very insidious and nasty stuff, I think, Mike.
Yes. Now, earlier on today, I spoke to Vanessa Bealey for a few minutes. Some pretty disturbing developments going on in Syria at the moment. And actually, it leads quite nicely into a discussion with Dr. Graham Downing. So let's watch the discussion that I had with Vanessa first. Okay, welcome to the programme, Vanessa. We're just going to start off with this tweet from the British Embassy. I believe this was from just about a year ago. The UK is strengthening the Free Syrian Police with training and equipment, and that's through UK aid. Now, many people would have heard of the Free Syrian Police. I certainly hadn't, even though this tweet is a year old already, and we'll see that this organisation existed for quite a bit longer than that. But this tweet, referring to £8.5 million, in fact, that should be, although the graphic says dollars, it was actually £8.5 million, was amongst a tranche of non-humanitarian aid that went into Syria, including £15 million for the White Helmets, £3.1 million to supposedly help with the fight against chemical weapons, £12 million for so-called moderate voices, civil society and human rights, £5.3 million for media activists. And of course, that I'm sure BBC Media Action was involved in that. They were talking about 300 Syrian journalists and activists receiving training in order to develop an independent Syrian media, reporting produced by civil society groups and the likes of the White Helmets. So that's, in fact, some more money going into the White Helmets there. £15.1 million for governance and service delivery, £3.8 million for the Syrian National Coalition, £4.4 million for moderate armed opposition, £29.3 million for impact on the wider region. And this section, £8.2 million for so-called security and justice. So how come, Vanessa, how come we haven't heard a lot more about the Free Syrian Police?
Well, it's very interesting, Mike. And in fact, what we're seeing here is a complete parallel to what the UK did in Kosovo, in the fact that they funded and armed the KLA, the terrorist groups there affiliated to Al-Qaeda. They created the Kosovo police. They armed, trained and funded them. And of course, they created actually a citizen journalist base to propagate the propaganda. So we're seeing a complete mirroring of the blueprint that was created with the partitioning of former Yugoslavia. First point. Second point, the Free Syrian Police was actually set up at the same time as the White Helmets in 2013 by the Syrian opposition, the SNC. I'm going to quickly rely on my notes a little bit here. Philip Hammond at that time made a statement to UK Parliament that they were underarmed and under-equipped. Then through the Assistance Coordination Unit that is also funded by the UK government, William Hague in 2015 made a statement again to the UK Parliament that 750,000 at that time would be gifted to the Free Syrian Police in order to provide body armor, helmets, CS spray, night vision goggles, and you'll like the brackets here, early warning system for regime helicopters. So again, hardly a neutral security force. And again, this is another example of the UK shadow state building, the decentralization away from the elected Syrian government into particularly Idlib, which is also where the White Helmets are centered. The Free Syrian Police is centered in Idlib, which is predominantly controlled by Nusra Front and ISIS and other extremist militant factions funded by the NATO state coalition.
Okay, well, look, one of the reasons that we're raising this now is because a new video has come to light. So let's have a look at that video and then we can discuss it afterwards.
Ahsan! Ad! Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Allahu Akbar!
Ala!
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 Kul!
Kul!
Man!
Man!
Tagha!
Tagha!
Watajabbar!
Watajabbar!
Tahya Turkiya!
Tahya Turkiya!
Tahya Turkiya!
Tahya Turkiya!
Tahya Turkiya!
Tahya Turkiya!
Yahya Erdogan!
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 تحيا سوريا حرة أبية
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 تحيا تركيا
تحيا تركيا
تحيا تركيا
تحيا تركيا
يحيى أردوغان
يحيى أردوغان
يحيى أردوغان
يحيى أردوغان
الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر
الله أكبر
على
على
كل
كل
من
من
طغى وتجبر طغى وتجبر
الله
أكبر
الله أكبر يا الله بسم الله 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 الله أكبر
So, Vanessa, I wanted to highlight this still from the video itself. I mean, this is a pretty militarized organization. But what I found particularly fascinating was that as they marched away, they are wearing blue helmets. And of course, light sky blue helmets are traditionally a symbol of peace because they're normally worn, blue helmets, blue berets, normally worn by UN peacekeepers. And they chose sky blue because nobody else was using that color. And therefore, you know, you could not, if you shot one of them, you couldn't be accused of mistaking them for an enemy troop in a war zone. So bearing in mind how militarized this crowd seemed to be, that's a pretty obscene thing to do, isn't it?
Well, I mean, in the chanting, they're actually swearing allegiance, of course, they're saying to Syria, but of course it's to the opposition, the armed opposition inside Syria, and to Erdogan, which again links them into this decentralization and partitioning of Syria. The funding for the Free Syrian Police comes through the UK Conflict Stability and Security Fund, but it's also being contributed to by the US, Denmark and Holland, are the three countries that I found to be named in the paperwork that I looked through. Now, this force is numbering now 6,000. So it's double the official figures of the White Helmets, for example, which is the British shadow state construct that we've been focusing on for some time. So it's double the numbers of that. Looking at that video, we can see how professionally equipped and how professionally trained they are. This is, as you say, quite rightly, this is not a police force. This looks very much like an armed militant force. And again, if we look at Idlib right now, we have, with the influx of all the various terrorist and extremist factions from the areas that have been liberated, like, for example, East Aleppo, we now have 5 million in Idlib alone. So that is a huge number of what are potentially majority and primarily extremist factions. So then you're introducing a force of well-trained, and I would suggest military-trained, Free Syrian Police, 6,000 men, 150 commanding officers, which sounds very much like a military structure. And I'll just read you something from an Al Arabiya, so from a Saudi media outlet, which came out a couple of days ago. So the focus is now actually turning to the Free Syrian Police, which is interesting, as the White Helmet's importance in Syria seems to have waned with the liberation of East Aleppo. I mean, the White Helmets are no longer appearing on our screens, except in relation to the Oscars or to their latest award-winning documentary film. But actual narrative from the White Helmets has disappeared, of course, because East Aleppo has now been liberated and they are no longer of much use, and they've been relocated either back to Turkey, where they were being incubated in the first place, or to Idlib. But this was actually the statement in Al Arabiya. We are the people, so this was a spokesperson for the Free Syrian Police, but we are the people born from the womb of the revolution, the sons of the revolution, and the servants of the Syrian revolution. He then went on to confirm to Al Arabiya English that there exists a contract stating armed factions respect the neutrality of the police factions. But he does admit that their relationship with the Free Syrian Army, which we know no longer exists, that it's been absorbed into the various extremist and terrorist factions like ISIS and Nusra Front, the relationship between the Free Syrian Police and the Free Syrian Army, the armed wing of the opposition, is excellent. So, you know, even within Saudi media, we're seeing a very clear collusion and allegiance between these terrorist forces that are occupying Idlib under the control of Turkey. Turkey's supplying the electricity to northern Idlib, and it's taking payment for that electricity in Turkish currency. You can see on the uniform of the Free Syrian Police, they have the Turkish crescent. So this is a very clear armed occupation by proxy, again, as you say, under the light blue helmets, which is a disgusting a dissembling of this armed insurgents inside Syria, because it's, as you said, it's going to suggest to people UN peacekeeping force, perhaps along the lines of the White Helmets being an NGO, a humanitarian NGO first response unit, committing and facilitating atrocities alongside Nusra Front. The Free Syrian Police will be doing exactly the same thing, but worryingly, it's an even larger force.
Yes. Well, let's just remind ourselves what the badge looks like. There it is. And remind ourselves again, British government funding this organization. So let's look at some earlier.
Also, that badge, Mike, that's obviously the French colonial flag. That's the FSA flag.
Right. So let's have a look at some earlier imagery of the Free Syrian Police. These next two news articles, this first one from Al Jazeera, this is from 2014. We have a group of guys here with the emblems on, so this is clearly Free Syrian Police, and they are quite clearly giving German Nazi salutes. There's no doubt about this, Vanessa, and we have another one here from EA Worldview with another image of the same group of guys. So we see very clearly what British Foreign Office money is going towards building extreme right-wing ideology.
Well, extreme right-wing, extreme... I mean, you know, if you take some of the extreme ideology in this world that is fundamentally destroying this world, you take Zionism, Wahhabism, and Nazism, there are huge ideological links between them in their elitism and their bigotry. And so, yes, you know, we're seeing yet again that the UK is using taxpayers' money to fund extremism inside Syria.
This was probably the most disturbing image that I'd seen. And this has come from the British government's website here. Yep. This is showing the Free Syrian Police giving vaccinations to children. apparently for polio. Now, since when were vaccinations a role of the police?
Exactly. Absolutely.
And just to give, and I don't know, you could fill me in on this, Vanessa, just to give some extra background to this. Here is an article from The Guardian, also from the end of 2014. At least 34 children die from contaminated measles vaccine. So I don't know if those two things were actually linked, but it seems to me that what you had there was unqualified people handling vaccines, giving vaccines to children. Were the vaccines safe? It's absolutely disgraceful that this was going on.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is something that probably Graham Dowling could respond to. But certainly in September 2014, this was a dreadful thing that happened, in the sense they claimed that the measles vaccines had been contaminated, and that is what killed 34 children in Idlib. So it was in the same area where the Free Syrian Police is centered. And yes, I mean, it's hard not to make some sort of speculative correlation between the images in May 2014 of this police force administering vaccinations, which, as you say quite rightly, why are the white helmets, if they are the medical counterparts, why are they not administering these vaccines? It's peculiar, to say the least, and it's extremely disturbing. It's certainly worthy of further investigation.
So, Graham, let's bring you straight in at that point and say, you know, what are your thoughts of this vaccination aspect and the fact that police are handling vaccines and giving vaccines to children?
Oh, well, I mean, it's incredulous, isn't it? Because anyone who's involved in any kind of medical intervention, there are so many stages of where things can go wrong, even just for the distribution of vaccinations, to what temperature they're kept at, the type of delivery system you're going to use, what you use, how you use it. And, you know, medical physicians and nurses are trained extensively in all of those things, and even they get it wrong. So to think that you would be able to just sort of transplant all of that into an area into Syria, with God knows what chaos is going on out there anyway, and then just immediately, I don't know, give a weekend course in how to do this, is absurd. It's absurd in the extreme. And I think it's very worrying. I mean, I'm not happy about the vaccination schedule and what happens in well-trained medical professionals in the UK, for example, or America or other Western countries. And there's lots of problems and issues of that in the scientific literature. So God help us if they're trying to do this in a war-torn place like Syria.
Particularly because clearly there must be some degree of encouragement, shall we say, by the police. The police tend to be, particularly that group, is likely to be pretty heavy-handed about it.
I would say so, but if you look in UK at the moment, you're seeing the fact that the government policy for integrating the police, the fire service and first aiders, this has been a major drive over the last couple of years. So we are going to see police. Of course, they say, well, the police are first on the scene for accidents very often, therefore it makes sense for them to be trained as first aiders. That is absolutely correct. That's the sort of logic, but in behind it, you drive, well, the police are going to be holding people down while social services say that adult needs to be vaccinated.
Mm. Yes. Okay. Well, Graham, let's talk about Vaxxed. This is just for anybody that isn't aware, give us the background to the film itself.
Well, the film is it's an interesting film because obviously it produced one of the producers was Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And if you look up Dr. Andrew Wakefield, immediately you're going to get a whole, you know, series of news articles that absolutely pull him over the coals and make out that he's the worst thing ever in medicine and he's disgraced and blah, blah, blah. I did a whole lecture on this the last day at Alternative View event. And I didn't really have a massive interest in him or in the MMR thing, but I thought I would have a look at it and just see how, you know, just see what this is about. And what I found was a completely different story from the one that we're being told about. You know, and it does appear that Dr. Wakefield, you know, even to give him the benefit of the doubt, that he was actually a target of attack because he dared to mention anything to do with autism and vaccines in the same sentence. Now, to be completely accurate. He never said that vaccines caused autism, and he never said that you shouldn't vaccinate. But that's the story that's been put forward, and there's a whole lot of other stuff on it as well. Now, I haven't got time to get into that. But anyway, he's one of the producers in this movie, and this movie is really about someone else. It's about a whistleblower in America called Dr. Thompson, and he works for the CDC. It was a huge, huge, probably the largest public health organization in the world, and its job is to regulate and to bring out laws and to make recommendations about things like vaccines. And what he said in this film, and what he said is that, and he openly admits it, he said when it came to a pivotal study that was meant to be done to rebut Dr. Wakefield's study, which suggested that there might be some problem with vaccines and autism, they brought this study out, the CDC did, put a lot of time and effort and money into it, and they turned in this study, this landmark study, they said it's nonsense what Dr. Wakefield said, there is no connection. Then subsequently, years down the road, one of their senior scientists who was involved in this study then turned around and said, well, actually, we lied. We lied, we took proper scientific evidence, and this evidence was damning. This evidence suggested very strongly that there was some association in a particular group, and at that time they said it was African-American boys, but subsequently other data has come out, and like I said, we don't have time to get into all of that. But anyway, what they said was we lied. They said we met in a room, we took the information that kind of proved that Dr. Wakefield was correct, and we said this can't come out, so they destroyed it and they threw it all in a big garbage can. I mean, it is absolutely and utterly unbelievable. Well, the movie is about that. It's not about Dr. Wakefield. It's about that. And it's a very good movie. It's a very good documentary, and it's accurate. And you know what? Not everyone's going to agree on everything. But what we must agree on, surely, is that government officials at that level cannot lie about information that affects the lives of young children.
Well, indeed. Now, I remember at the time that this scandal was, that the controversy, rather, was kicking off. I remember, because I used to take the train into Euston Station and walk from Euston to another place. And on my journey, there were protests outside one of the hospitals in support of Dr. Wakefield at that time. Do you get any indication that he still has support within the National Health Service?
I think my understanding is that anyone who takes the time to look into the subject, any subject really, but particular vaccination, all is not what it seems to be. Now, I'm not pro or anti. I don't have a dog in the fight. I don't have a vaccine injured child, and I don't know Dr. Wakefield, but my interest more is about truth within science and also about freedom of speech. You know, people should be allowed to express their opinion about a subject if they've got evidence that needs, you know, that good evidence that needs to be looked at. And what you find is when you go into literature, if someone makes a claim about something, there'll be a study, and underneath there'll be very, very rarely will you ever see a comment. But when anything goes up about vaccination literature, immediately there's comments, immediately it comes under attack. And what you'll usually find most of the times is these statements, these reports and these published studies are retracted. And that is very, very strange, because that's not common in science. That doesn't happen like that. And it does seem to be, when you look at it, there's a huge bias to put one side of the argument. And I always say, and when I lecture and I give talks, I say the way to understand this is to think about gravity. You know, when you come up, if you sit there and an apple lands on your head, you could say, well, I think there might be something in my head attracting that apple. That could be your theory, as silly as that sounds. And you test it out and you realize, well, it's not that, but you do see apples falling. And then you go around the world, you go to China, India, wherever you go, these things fall off the trees, or something falls off the trees. So you come up with a concept of gravity. Now, that's your hypothesis. And until that's shot down, that's what we believe. Now, the hypothesis about vaccination, that it's effective, that it's safe, and it works to prevent disease, fine, there are studies that do support that. But it's the equivalent of going into a different country or going somewhere else, and instead of these apples coming down in support, they go flying off into space and don't come down again. So in other words, there's evidence that doesn't support that. So you have this, at the very least you've got a mixed bag of evidence. And when you get that with a hypothesis, what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to bin it and say, well, obviously not all the studies support it, and we have to get rid of this hypothesis. And medicine and the powers to be do not want that to happen. So therefore, anything that criticizes it is cut short is removed from publication, and freedom of choice and freedom of speech is shut down.
Okay, well, the reason we're mentioning this now, of course, is because the British premiere of Vaxxed was supposed to be held in the Curzon Cinema in Soho on the 14th of February. And unfortunately, on Thursday or Friday last week, the Curzon Cinema decided that that private showing could not happen. They subsequently issued a statement which said, "It has been brought to our attention that a large number of the general public have strong concerns about the upcoming presentation of Andrew Wakefield's documentary Vaxxed at our venue, Curzon Soho. The screening is not part of the Curzon programme, rather it is a private hire hosted by the filmmakers themselves. Part of our business is to provide entirely impartial democratic event space in which anyone can hire our screens for events and film screenings. All private hires are unaffiliated with the Curzon brand or any of our venues, and we consider such events to be an entirely separate concern from that of our public-facing activity. The presentation of Vaxxed is an example of this distinction being unclear, and we now unwittingly find ourselves at the heart of the discussion around it to a degree where we must take a stance on the material. In light of the responses we have received from members of the public, we have decided to cancel the private hire contract and pull the film from our venue. We do not wish to profit from a film that has demonstrably caused great distress." So that's what the Curzon says. Graham, you know, what other light can you shed on this?
Well, as I said, I'm not involved in the organisation of it or whatever, but my understanding is that the people that did organise it, my understanding is from what they're saying is that apparently it was one person, maybe two people that actually called that cinema. And these people are, I don't know these people, I'm not out to make a comment on them, but all I know is from what I've been told is that they're very either pro-vax or anti-Dr. Wakefield or one of the two or a mixture of the above. But these people are known, they're activists, and they do this. So my understanding first is that there isn't a public outcry in the sense that there's a very limited number of people, maybe one or two, that kind of know each other and kind of revved each other up to make a complaint to shut this down. And further from that, my understanding is just that the organisers weren't even contacted to give a right of reply or even to have their side of the argument put forward. What just happened was a few people rang. It was all highly organised. There are known kind of activists that do this. And then the Curzon just buckled under. And like I said, I don't have a dog in the fight. But to me, that doesn't sound right. I mean, if you're in England in 2017, you're telling me that you can't, private people who have booked, who know what the subject matter, they know what it's about, they're young mums, some with babies, some not, very normal people, suddenly they've been shut out and they can't do that. And no crime has been committed here. I don't, from a legal point of view, I don't really understand this. Because what next? If I ring up and say I don't agree with XYZ, I can get groups shut down. I mean, you know, with no basis in law. I mean, Jesus Christ, what are we going to do? We're going to start burning books in England? I mean, it's disgraceful that this has happened.
Yeah.
Well, Graham, if I can just add a little bit in there, in a minute we're going to be talking on the subject of fake news. I think that press statement from Curzon was incredibly professionally and well crafted, because of course, first of all, it said that they were impartial. They offered their facilities to anyone to talk about whatever subject they want. But by the end of that media statement, they said that basically this nasty film has caused many people distress. And as you've just said, that was done without any evidence. So I think they would have used a very high profile media team to put that response together. And I would imagine that actually Curzon has come under some pretty heavy pressure from within the government. That's just my personal opinion. I'll try and add a bit to that when I look at the fake news story in just a minute.
Okay, let's move on to DNA. Now, this is from earlier this week. DNA, of course, is your subject, Graham. And this is The Guardian. The headline is Organisms Created with Synthetic DNA Pave the Way for New Life Forms. And The Guardian is saying that E. coli microbes have been modified to carry an expanded genetic code, which researchers say will ultimately allow them to be programmed. They say that from the moment life gained a foothold on Earth, Its story has been written in a DNA code of four letters with G, T, C, and A, the molecules that pair up in the DNA helix. The lines between human and all life on Earth are spelled out. Now, the first living organisms to thrive with an expanded genetic code have been made by researchers to work in work that paves the way for the creation and exploitation of entirely new life forms. Scientists in the US modified common E. coli microbes to carry a beefed up payload of genetic material, which they say will ultimately allow them to program how organisms operate and behave. The work is aimed at making bugs that churn out new kinds of proteins, which can be harvested and turned into drugs to treat a range of diseases. Graham, this is incredibly close to playing God, I think. But am I just a Luddite for saying, making a statement like that?
Well, okay. When, as you know, everyone has an opinion on something. And if you're in the pub, you know, if you're with your mates, that's one thing. But then when you get on to a public platform, as you guys know, you start speaking. Well, at least I hope everyone does. You start to think, you know, is what I'm saying accurate? Is it fair what I'm saying? And I'm always second guessing, and I'm always open to be wrong. Of course, we're open to be wrong, you know, and not to have that kind of one track mentality. And I know exactly what you're saying, because, and we, you know, back in the, just a simple thing like anatomy, just a simple thing where you're a medical student undergoing anatomy on a cadaver, like a dead body, and being able to dissect it and do some stuff and learn about anatomy. Well, you know, that caused problems, you know, all the way up until, you know, relatively recently. I mean, I think it was only until about 1832 that the Anatomy Act was passed. And prior to that, if these guys that procured these dead bodies, you know, they'd be attacked, they'd be whipped, there'd be riots. But after that, they said, "Well, we'll make an act, and you can just get the paupers." They went, "Okay, then we won't worry about them." And now, of course, anatomy is accepted at doing dissection. So I know what you mean, because then you think, "Well, am I being a bit, you know, kind of dogmatic and a bit kind of old-fashioned? Would be the wrong word, but am I, you know, am I preventing science from moving forward?" The way to look at this, I think, Mike, is up until now, if you imagine we're on a boat, okay, and we're sailing in this great big blooming sea, and the boat is the human race, okay, or it's the human body, whichever analogy you want to use. Up until now, we've been painting the boat, we've been changing the sails, we've been going down into the engine room, we've been removing a few things and putting a few things back. But when you come down to this level, what you're doing now is you're actually starting to pull up the floorboards of this boat. And if you get it wrong, God forbid if you get this wrong, you just may find you're sinking the human race. Now, I hope to God I'm wrong, and I always say this, because these are the subjects you want to be wrong on. Now, don't get me, you know, look, they're going to discover some amazing things, and no doubt they're going to be able to help people. When the last one we did, we looked at a DNA technique called CRISPR, where they were editing genes, and they managed to save a very young baby's life against a rare form of leukemia, and that's absolutely awesome. But we are pushing now so close, and if we make errors here, whereas before they could be absorbed, you know, but now we are pushing very, very, very close, because you're talking about here synthetic life, and not just the the kind of philosophical, religio-philosophical or spiritual aspect to this. You know, I mean, how are we gonna feel? Because this really is linked into transhumanism, artificial intelligence, the whole nine yards. How are we gonna feel when we are coexisting, because this is what we're now talking about, all this stuff comes to fruition, coexisting with a life form that, in terms of intelligence and strength, not talking about strength, sorry, not talking about spiritual aspects, will be superior to us. And you know, because you guys are a student of history, you know, students of history, that if you look back through history, whatever life form it is or species, if you have one that is stronger than the other one doesn't survive. The other one is subjugated. And these are things which really do need to be thought about. And in fact, they are thought about, and authors publish on this, and academics publish on this. So, but the point is, none of this is stopping this moving forward. This is moving forward. And sometimes you might have to ask the question, just because we can doesn't mean that we should. And that doesn't seem to exist in these labs and in the people that are funding these developments at the moment.
But it doesn't. There doesn't seem to be the public debate. I mean, what you've just said, just because you can doesn't mean you should, of course, is a famous quote from a certain movie with dinosaurs in it. if you remember. So, you know, that when was that made? In the mid-1990s, and here we are 20 years later, and we're still having the same conversation, and actually the public debate doesn't seem to have moved on too far. What is it actually going to take, do you think, before there is some kind of public discussion on this?
Well, what has astounded me is that the indication was given that there's no way they'd cross these Rubicons. These rivers, these lines in the sand, there was no way they'd ever be crossed, and there'd always be debate. And then suddenly we've kind of, our eyes come off the ball, and then suddenly all these labs are starting to push forward. And the recent one last year was an American university that just sort of announced, oh yeah, we're going to have a meeting, we're going to chat about something, and what we're going to do is we're going to take human stem cells from a human, and we're going to insert them into an animal brain, and we're just going to see what happens. And it's all to do with research for the greater good, because it means we can work out about mental issues and Alzheimer's. And don't get me wrong, those things are massively important. But there was no thought given to, well, don't you think you need to really speak to the public properly about this? Do we want human cells growing in an animal brain? Now, that's, as far as I understand, is on the way, and that's ongoing research. But that's huge. That is a massive Rubicon. And that just was just literally put out there in a press release.
Yeah. Any thoughts?
I have, but let's just do our advert, and then we'll come on to fake news, because I think that spin and fake news is part of the problem here.
Okay, so just a reminder that Sunday the 5th of February, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m., Cathedral View Room, Brayport Centre in Dunblane, is the next UK Column / Northern Exposure meeting. David Scott, very keen for as many people as possible to turn up to that. More details as we go, but we'll keep reminding about that over the next couple of days.
Okay, well, let's delve straight into fake news. And my goodness, we're seeing some extraordinary things come out of the BBC, main newspapers and other TV outlets. But here's the BBC and the big headline, fake news inquiry by MPs examines threat to democracy. So fake news now, Mike, has become so serious. It didn't just skew Brexit or perhaps skew the American election. It's now threatening democracy itself, and MPs have set themselves up to challenge what's going on. So here's The Guardian, MPs to investigate threat to democracy from fake news. Interesting that joint headline. And the gentleman in the picture is Damian Collins. We'll come back onto him in a moment. I think they're panicking because basically if they have lost control of the public mind, we're no longer thinking what they're telling us to think. We are going to start exploring what's really going on. If we talk the DNA research, there's no debate, Mike, because the mainstream media won't allow it.
Yeah.
So here's the BBC, and they're on the subject of BBC trending. And they say there are ways of stopping this terrible fake news. Shutting down the BBC comes to mind, but that's not mentioned in their report. And here's the man, Damian Collins, and he's been heading up a special committee, and it's the committee themselves that's decided to investigate the fake news. This isn't some edict from central government, allegedly, at least not according to the secretary of the committee that we spoke to this morning. So what's this man saying? Well, he says the rise of propaganda and fabrications is a threat to democracy and undermines confidence in the media in general. So that's pretty heavy stuff. He goes on, just as a major tech companies have accepted that they have a social responsibility to combat piracy online and the illegal sharing of content, they also need to help address the spreading of fake news on social media platforms. Consumers should also be given new tools to help them assess the origin and likely veracity of news stories that they read online. So we need more work from the technical companies like Facebook, and we need to be taught. The committee will be investigating these issues as well as looking into the sources of fake news, what motivates people to spread it, and how it's been used around elections and other important political debates. These people are terrified, Mike.
Yes.
There is no question here. They really don't know what to do. Now, I think we can shed a bit of light on where the fear comes from. He is the man. So the first thing you do is go and look at his background. And what you see at the bottom is that he was a desk officer and a press officer with the Conservatives. There's the little Conservative tree. Then he was working for Saatchi and Saatchi, M&C Saatchi, as it's called. And, of course, they were heavily into political campaigning. And then he went on to another company called Lexicon. Then he becomes an MP. So if we have a look at the sort of stuff that was done, this is just some of the material about Saatchi helping the Conservatives stay in the European Union campaign. So if you talk Saatchi, you talk politics. What was their job? Spinning media to convince people in a direction they wouldn't otherwise go. And here's the chief executive of Saatchi. He says, "We're delighted to have been appointed to the Prime Minister's," that was David Cameron's campaign. "It builds on the extremely close relationship we've enjoyed with the party since 1978. So this is not a quick dip under the covers together. This is a full-blown relationship since 1978. And the successful recent campaigning we did together during last year's general election campaign." So Saatchi is the Tory party. And on it goes. Clearly, Europe doesn't need to change, but we believe that the UK should be leading that reform, changing Europe for the better on our terms. For a stronger, safer Europe, we say don't leave, lead. So is the we the Conservative Party, or is we the is we Saatchi's?
And who's driving Conservative policy then?
I think this company is.
Right.
So just to show that in the short time available, we did our research. This was PR Week. And what are they flagging up? They're flagging up that basically Damian Collins, oh, that's the MP.
Yes.
Right. He's just been taken on by Lexington Communications. So here is a magazine clearly saying that if we get into public media, we're into lobbying.
That's from 2008, so that was just before he became an MP.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yes. As I'll show that. So if we go delving into Lexington Communications, and remember the MP, Damian Collins, was formerly involved with this, they, on their website at the moment, have a little article about fake news. So they're definitely still in the game.
Okay.
So we went and had a look at their directors. So we've got this man here. And so if we've got a Tory involved, here's one of the senior directors, Mike Craven, used to be a political advisor and chief media spokesperson for the Labour Party. Okay. So it was pretty cross-party political agenda. We can bring in this man here. He's just an expert in crisis issues, management and corporate reputation. So that one's going strongly. And then we've got this gentleman. And he's very, very interesting because he's been involved with ITV and helping to write an IPPR document on BBC's future. So we could say, well, he's pretty into the mainstream.
And special advisor to two secretaries of state there, I noticed.
Yes, a little bit of political. So I labelled this what's going on under the bedclothes. So here is the man heading the inquiry into fake news, who's up to his unmentionables with the Tory party, previous history desk and press officer. Big history with Saatchi's, who's working with both Labour and the Conservatives. Then he moves into Lexington Communications. And they've got links, of course, with work for the Tory party and Labour through their particular professionals in the company. This was the guy we flagged up, Nigel Warner, and he produced this report on the BBC, which is all very cuddly. But it gets better than that because he's also got a charity which is getting black and minority ethnic people into the creative industries. And who is one of his partners, would you like to guess? Unfair Live. Well, of course, it's the BBC. And then we can say, well, of course, the BBC gives the same MP a massive platform to talk about fake news. And I'll just add in here, there seems to be a link between Lexington and health services, private health services,
okay,
which is very big in the Tory party. So I think this gentleman was specially selected. I don't think this is to do with tackling fake news. I think it goes like this, that basically what we're seeing is all of these vast PR companies that used to rake in millions from driving public opinion are now showing they can't drive public opinion because people like ourselves and individuals on the internet are doing a better job. Therefore, their contracts are going to disappear. Therefore, we're using MPs to help lobby for the PR companies. So as reported by the BBC, this is nothing to do with fake news. This is to do with big companies panicking that their contracts are going to disappear down the plug hole.
Mm. Just before we go, Graham, thank you very much for joining us. Have you got any final thoughts?
Yeah, very interesting piece that was. One of the things I wanted to quickly say was, I forgot to say, is that up until now, up until nuclear weapons were birthed, we relatively could not destroy ourselves. Obviously, nuclear weapons are a bad thing, but in order to build those, I'm reliably informed, you need lots of money, lots of very rare components, and they can be very easily detected, thank God, by security services. This new technology, this DNA stuff we're talking about, can be done relatively inexpensively by relatively few people. And the industry itself recognizes that that is a massive problem. And at some point, this stuff will get into the wrong hands. So that is yet another reason why this stuff has got to be sorted properly and with full transparency.
And for that, we need a fully operational, working, transparent news service. So I would say if we want to stop a lot of what's going on, we've got to tackle the fake news being pumped out by government-sponsored news outlets, of which the BBC's got to be one of the main ones. Mm. Okay. Graham, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for today. And we will say, as always, thank you to all the people who have donated to us. Thank you very much to the individual that sent us one of the smallest envelopes we've ever received. Just enough space for the two stamps, but we were delighted when we opened it. So thank you very much for that donation. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.